This is Functional Medicine Update for August 1998, Volume 17, Number 8. This month we will focus our attention on the new trends in medicine. Our interview, for example, is with Regina Hertzlinger, author of the best-selling book, Market-Driven Healthcare. Other new trends discussed in this edition will include research on why patients use alternative medicine, the new acceptance of folic acid usage by mainstream medicine, a 20-year update of the James Freeze hypothesis, mitochondrial DNA restriction and mutations in elite athletes, new adverse drug reactions, Parkinson's disease and environmental exposure, the expanded view of inflammation in immune dysfunction, cardiovascular disease and GALT dysfunction. And our final report will be on tocotrienols inhibiting the growth of breast cancer cells. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the August 1998 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for August 1998. Well, I hope your summer is going well and that you've had some opportunity in the summer to get away for a few days and do some reading and some updating and information in a warm, enjoyable, nice place around the world somewhere where you're away from the distractions of the normal day and kind of into the vacation mode. This August, we've got a tremendous program in Functional Medicine Update that I think you will find, if you're using this as vacation listening, to be a most exciting and hopefully informative experience. So much is happening in our field. It's really a revolutionary period of time for us to be living through, creating, and being a participant in the shaping of what I think is going to be a reforming of the healthcare delivery system globally. I just had the opportunity to travel to Brazil, and I was so impressed with the number of practitioners in Brazil who have caught the wave of what we might call functional medicine and nutritional medicine. Some 600 medical doctors attended a presentation that I made down in São Paulo as part of a program that went on for 4 days and had several hundred practitioners involved in learning new skills and tools in the area of functional and nutritional medicine. Wherever I travel in the world, I'm amazed at the receptivity and the interest and the enthusiasm and the research interest, the cooperativism that's starting to develop around this changing paradigm, again, to derive a term and steal from Thomas Kuhn. You know, this really all started to pick up speed, it seems, when we reported back in 1993 of the landmark paper by Dr. David Eisenberg that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, that awakened physicians around the world to the fact that there was a third or second tier medical system called alternative care that was going on right beneath their vision that was extraordinarily large. And there was much involvement of their patients with this system, which most doctors didn't know about. The paper, Unconventional Medicine in the United States, Prevalence, Cost, and Patterns of Use, that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1993, really alerted practitioners to this extraordinary trend and the changes that were occurring as a consequence. And I think the most interesting thing, of course, in that study was the recognition that not only was there a high prevalence of use, but that the individuals using these services were highly educated, had a reasonably high discretionary incomes, and were electing out of pocket to support these services of complementary medicine. We are also, I think, very interested in how this is followed up. Has this trend continued? What is the basic nature of the change? What is the mechanism for people making a decision to employ the services of a complementary physician? That has been addressed very nicely in a more recent paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, authored by Dr. John Aston, entitled Why Patients Use Alternative Medicine, Results of a National Study. In this particular report, where he describes the results of a study looking for variables that characterize an individual who is using alternative medical services relative to age and ethnicity and gender and education and income, some very interesting things come out of that. First of all, with regard to age, it's pretty well distributed from age 18 through age greater than 65, with the greatest prevalence being probably individuals 50 to 64 years of age, about 42%, and 4% for individuals 35 to 49. Ethnicity, fairly good distribution of ethnicity. The very high prevalence of use in Native American, fairly high percentage use in Asian Pacific and Hispanic, and a reasonably high, about 41% of Caucasians were found also to be users of alternative medicine. In gender, I was very interested to see it's reasonably well distributed between male and female, about 39% of males, 41% of females. Education, more highly educated. Graduate degree of 50% of individuals with graduate degrees, 45% of people with bachelor's degree. Household income, about 44%, people over the income greater than $60,000 a year, about 44% for people between $40,000 and $60,000 household income a year. So we're talking about reasonably well-educated and individuals who have higher discretionary incomes. What are the most frequently used alternative programs and for what conditions? Again, in a rank order, it was found that chronic pain was number one, with exercise, chiropractic, massage right at the head of the list of alternative approaches. Anxiety, again, exercise and relaxation and herbs and music therapy. Chronic fatigue syndrome, or CFS, massage, exercise, self-help, and nutritional intervention. Sprains and muscle strains, chiropractic, exercise, massage, and relaxation and herbs. Addictive problems ranked next, psychotherapy, self-help groups, and nutrition intervention. Next was arthritis or rheumatism, again, probably tied together with chronic pain, but exercise, chiropractic, homeopathy, herbs, and nutritional intervention and diet. Severe headaches, chiropractic, massage, exercise, relaxation, digestive problems, lifestyle and diet ranking number one, relaxation, herbs, and chiropractic. And lastly, blood sugar irregularities and or diabetes, which were diet, nutritional intervention, exercise, and stress reduction. So those represented the rank order in decreasing order of frequency of the uses of what we call alternative medicine, according to this article. And the conclusion was that along with being more educated and reporting poor health status, the majority of the alternative medicine users appear to be doing so not so much as a result of being dissatisfied with conventional medicine, but largely because they find these healthcare alternatives to be more congruent with their own values, the beliefs that they have about their body in relationship to their health and the environment, and philosophical orientations towards health and life. So we're seeing a really philosophical shift in the belief system about medicine and about healing and about the body's own natural recoverative or reparative mechanisms, and I think that is reflected then in the use of these different kinds of services. I think the takeaway from this very interesting paper is that the driver is not necessarily dissatisfaction with their medical doctor or with medicine, but more a seeking out for a more ecologically based, web-like form of healthcare delivery, focused more on the mind-body interrelationship, incorporating things that are now considered part of the healing process that previously were outside the bounds of medicine, which are environmental and spiritual and sociological parameters, which now are starting to be integrated within a whole system that the person at the center of their own healing process is starting to pull together as their team. And that theme will pervade the whole course of this functional medicine update, and I think you'll see that functional medicine as a field of healthcare focused on the assessment and early intervention into the improvement of physiological, cognitive, emotional, and physical functioning is in fact a field of healthcare that is congruent or consistent with the reasons that people are seeking out alternative care, and the trend seems to be continuing well past the Eisenberg 1993 paper. One of the things that we learn about the interest in these forms of complementary therapies is the question as to whether they fit into some belief system that can be considered rational on the part of the user. Is there something that they can lock onto that seems to fall the rule of reasonableness, meaning that it seems to fit into their overall belief systems and how they see the world? For many individuals, this relates back to a scientific mechanistic view, somehow coupled together with a vitalistic view, this balancing between vitalism and reductionism. When we look at functional medicine, we certainly have founded its basic tenets on the balance between reductionism, a mechanistic understanding, and vitalism, the inherent symphony of physiology that occurs by mechanisms that we're still only starting to understand from a mechanistic perspective. But I think we should not forget nor diminish the importance of understanding mechanisms of chronic health problems that later become diseases that later then become premature cause of morbidity and mortality. And of course, one of the greatest examples of this is an example that we utilized just last issue of Functional Medicine Update. You recall we talked about Dr. Kilmer McCulley, who some 39 years ago as a pathologist at Harvard Medical School as a young assistant professor of medicine started to study homocysteine and found that it seemed to be related to the insufficiency of vitamins B6, B12, and folic acid. Even though the individuals who had this condition may be consuming a diet that's adequate in the levels of those nutrients relative to the recommended dietary allowances, for their own unique biochemical genetic needs, the levels they were consuming were inadequate, and they were expressing then the toxic levels of this homocysteine molecule that then increased their risk to premature heart disease. And as I mentioned to you, this is not just an academic subject, because over the last 30 years, it's been speculated that some 1.5 million people in the United States alone died prematurely as a consequence of hyperhomocysteemic injury to their arteries, causing premature coronary artery disease. These are fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers and grandfathers and grandmothers that still may have had many years of productive life left if it were not for the fact that they didn't take a few additional pennies worth of nutrients above the RDA each day for their own level of biochemical need. Well, that concept that I'm describing, which now is mechanistically well worked out through exhaustive studies from multiple clinicians and researchers over the last 30 years, as evidenced with a nice review paper that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled Homocysteine and Atherothrombosis, which appeared in the April 9, 1998 issue, page 1042. You recall in the start of that paper, the review author said, in 1969, Dr. McCulley made the clinical observation linking elevated plasma homocysteine concentrations with vascular disease. He reported autopsy evidence of extensive arterial thrombosis and atherosclerosis in two children with elevated plasma homocysteine concentrations and homocystinuria. They go on to say that although severe hyperhomocysteemia is rare, mild hyperhomocysteemia occurs in approximately 5-7% of the general populations. Patients with mild hyperhomocysteemia have none of the clinical signs of severe hyperhomocysteemia or homocystinuria and are typically asymptomatic until the third or fourth decade of life when premature coronary artery disease develops, as well as recurrent arterial and venous thrombosis, giving rise to increased risk to stroke and the like. Well, the interesting takeaway from this is that what was considered to be alternative medicine 30 years ago, God forbid that a physician would recommend higher doses of B6, B12, and folate for fear of exorcism from their colleagues, that they were recommending something that would be considered quackery, that is vitamin supplementation for individuals that would only then produce expensive urine at worst and maybe toxicity. That was the dominant thought until recently. And now suddenly what the New England Journal of Medicine has recently reported in an editorial that follows in that same issue of the journal, as we discussed last Functional Medicine Update, the title of it is Eat Right and Take a Multivitamin, in which they say since the mid-1970s, 25% of American adults have regularly consumed a multivitamin containing 400 micrograms of folic acid. The current evidence suggests that people who take such supplements and their children are healthier. This evidence raises the question of whether physicians and other healthcare professionals should recommend that all adults take a multivitamin daily. This is really responding to the very nice paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine and authored by Dr. Gil Omen and Manuel Malinow and colleagues, looking at the relationship of folic acid supplementation of breakfast cereals in individuals with coronary heart disease and examining whether, in fact, it had a positive impact on those who had hyperhomocysteemia and showing, in fact, that it did. I guess words and language and semantics become pretty important, don't they? They become fighting positions for some individuals. What was considered alternative and therefore unscientific and not mechanistically understood and not grounded, even as recently as 10 years ago, which is the supplementation of the diet with folate, B6, and B12 beyond the RDA levels for the prevention of heart disease, is now in the parlance and thought of 1998 considered to be good medicine, to be scientifically based, to be considered contemporary, current, breakthrough, at the cutting edge, that if you really are keeping up with the primary literature that you would know this and start to employ it, when really just but a few years ago it was considered alternative. So again, I think the balance between anecdote, personal experience, history, keeping the philosophy of recognition that we don't know all yet, and that clinical observation is often very important, particularly if it's observed by many, many people over long periods of time, and the risk of it is at least very minimal, and the benefit may be positive. And then as we accrue more scientific mechanistic understanding, then it becomes more and more within what we call the codification, the catechism of medicine. Similarly, we've had another theme that's been weaving its way through in the field of healthcare over the last 15 plus years, and that is the concept that was advanced by Dr. James Freese and colleagues in a now landmark paper that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1983, entitled Aging, Natural Death, and the Compression of Morbidity. Actually, it was 1980, as I now think about it, volume 303, page 130 in 1980 was the appearance of this article, in which Dr. Freese, professor of medicine at Stanford University Medical School, and I'm very proud to say presented our first international symposium on functional medicine some 7 years ago, described in that paper the fact that if one could work on compression of morbidity by increasing organ reserve through the election of positive, healthful lifestyles in a younger age, that one could retain organ reserve throughout midlife in a later age, and then they would have more in the bank account, so to speak, of their physiological reserve, which would then compress illness into the very last phase of their life, would rectangularize what the survival curve, meaning that more people would live out to the limits of their biological potential, having little disability throughout their life cycle, and that they would undergo more likely natural death rather than the highly technologically interventionist type of death that many people now experience in hospitals, intubated and mechanized. This paper was heavily criticized when it was published by many quarters within the medical community because it was said that there was no evidence whatsoever to indicate that individuals who, in fact, did change their lifestyles, improve their exercise, nutrition, environmental exposures, would, in fact, be able to retain organ reserve and compress morbidity and push themselves towards the limit of their biologically determined life expectancy and undergo natural death. Well, we're very pleased to see, all of us who have been supporters of the Freese hypothesis over these many years, a follow-up paper now some 18 years later by Dr. Freese and his colleagues from Stanford that appeared again in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 338, page 1035, discussing the results now on a prospective trial of this precept that if a person works on the right things, it'll pay off a benefit later in life. And this is basically a study looking at this compression of morbidity hypothesis. The study was 1,741 university alumni who were surveyed first in 1962 at an average age of 43 years, and then annually starting in 1986. A strata of high, moderate, and low risk were defined on the basis of smoking, body mass index, exercise patterns. Cumulative disability was determined with a health assessment questionnaire and scored on a scale of 0 to 3. Cumulative disability from 1986 to 1994, where the average age was 75 years, or death was the measure of lifetime disability. And then they compared the groups that did something against those that did not and asked the question, what was the outcome? What was the bottom line? What was the evidence? And what they found was that smoking, body mass index, and exercise patterns in midlife and late adulthood are predictors of subsequent disability. Not only do people with better health habits survive longer, meaning live longer, but in such persons, disability is postponed and compressed into the fewer years at the end of their life, i.e., they move towards natural death. A very powerful support for the hypothesis that Dr. Freese advanced some 18 years ago, and I think we're now moving it off the hypothesis to the mechanistically or at least recognized association between that of what you do to your body and how you maintain and preserve your organ reserve will then have a great bearing on how well you are when you need that reserve past the age of 60. In fact, the editorial that appears concurrent to the Freese paper is very powerful. It goes on to say that the Freese hypothesis questioned conventional wisdom, attacked the stereotype of old age as a time of disability and helplessness, and seemed overly optimistic to many people. Could helpful living really prevent the functional limitations that are so strongly associated with advancing age? And then he goes on to say that the results of the study clearly show that the answer is yes. We shouldn't overinterpret the results of the study. The endpoints were relatively low levels of disability. But still, I think this is a very encouraging support for the concept that working on functionality at a young age throughout one's life can have significant payoff and benefit as one ages. If we tie this together with the recent paper on take multivitamins that contain B6 folate and B12, because you may be one of the 5 to 7% of people with a heterozygous form of hyperhomocysteemia, we start to emerge a different paradigm in healthcare related to the physician's relationship to their patient, which is to construct a self-administered health promotion program, not just administering to a sick person some kind of in-organ therapy, but rather to look at the individual in the context of their life, their genetic background, and their personal health habits, and try to design a program that promotes full penetration of positive gene characteristics and their expression, and puts to sleep or turns off those gene expressions that lead to premature illness and death. I think that the closing paragraph in the editorial on the Freeze paper is a very interesting insight into this whole concept. Dr. Edward Campion says in close, "Our new expectations of a full lifespan makes deaths in youth and middle age seem all the more cruel and unnatural. When life does extend into the advanced decades and deterioration begins, it should be easier to avoid the futility of high technology interventions in people who are dying. Perhaps with a better understanding of aging, it will become easier to accept the fact that life ends, and that we can see even in the 10th decade of life, interventions with exercise programs can improve strength, improve function, and reduce the disability of age." So I think these are very optimistic, very positive affirmations of the functional medicine model that we've been discussing now for, well, what is it, more than 15 years on a Preventive Medicine Update followed by Functional Medicine Update. One of the themes that we're emerging, obviously, is related to our genetic factors and our inheritance factors and whether disease comes as a consequence of just having the bad luck of the draw with parents who gave us genes for disease. Well, one of those things that we have described, obviously, is that we can modify gene expression. There is a fairly wide range of how genes are expressed, except those individuals that may have gotten the genetic metabolism disease for infancy-related disorders. These are more severe genetic mutations. But for most of the what I call sublethal mutations that don't appear in their presentation and expression until midlife or beyond, there's a great variation in how we treat those genes as to how they will function for us in our phenotype throughout our life. One of the areas that we've described where gene uniqueness is becoming clinically interesting and important is in the area of mitochondrial DNA. Do you remember the story around mitochondrial DNA? We've said that it's the other place within a cell where genetic information is found. Dr. Derek Lonsdale spoke to this very beautifully in his clinical update focus discussion some 2 issues ago in Functional Medicine Update, where he talked about the clinical description of mitochondrial dysfunction and how it appeared as chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and allergic atopic disorders. This was the April 1998 issue of Functional Medicine Update. One has asked the question as to whether mitochondrial mutations and differences in mitochondrial inheritance, which comes from the mother, could influence in things like exercise performance and other functional characteristics that are associated with muscle function that might even be seen as fibromyalgia or fatigue-related syndromes. I'm very interested in this because of the Greg LeMond issue, the elite bicycle racer who was at the top of his game, the world's best, who then was forced into retirement as a consequence of induced mitochondrial myopathy, where it didn't appear as if his mitochondrial dysfunction was a consequence of having had bad parents, who, when I say bad parents, I mean his mother who gave him mitochondrial mutations, but rather that something happened to his mitochondria over his years of living that created a less than optimal energy efficient production system, because the mitochondria is where this oxidative phosphorylation and ATP generation occurs, and oxygen is reduced to water and carbon dioxide is produced. That's the furnace of the cell, the mitochondrion, and the energy powerhouse. And it appears as if his mitochondrial dysfunction in muscles was induced rather than genetically inherited. So people have asked questions as to whether there is a difference in elite athletes between their mitochondrial DNA and that of normal individuals. Do athletes really succeed as a consequence of having different energy machinery in their cells? And what is the frequency of mitochondrial DNA mutations in the mitochondria of athletes versus those of non-athletes? And a paper was just recently published that describes the results of this type of a hypothesis or question. This appeared in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, 1998, page 687. And the title of this paper is 3 Mitochondrial DNA Restriction Polymorphisms in Elite Endurance Athletes and Sedentary Controls. And what they found is that there was no statistical difference in mitochondrial mutations found between the sedentary controls and the elite athletes. However, in both those groups, it was found that there was a fairly significant penetration of mitochondrial DNA mutations, somewhere in the range of about 6 to 12%, depending upon the actual mitochondrial DNA restriction polymorphism that they were examining. So let's say, on average, about 10% of people studied, whether they're athletes or not athletes, had mitochondrial mutations that were looked for. And I want to remind you that it was only some 25 years ago that the first mitochondrial mutation and a relationship to a disease was discovered. And this was a Leber's optic neuropathy, and was considered to be a very esoteric condition that only affected one out of several hundred thousand individuals and therefore would be relegated to the archives of the medical research clinic. But since then, over 100 different kinds of mitochondrial DNA mutations have been identified. And the more that people look, the more that are found. So I think that if we said 10% of people have mitochondrial mutations, recall, if you would, that they're only looking at three mitochondrial DNA restriction polymorphisms, and 10% had those within those three loci. So if we were to look at all the possibilities, it may likely be more than 10% of the population carries mitochondrial DNA uniquenesses. Now, what does that mean in terms of energy performance and how different mitochondria may be susceptible to oxidative stress, to sensitivity to toxins or interleukins that are generated through an upregulated immune system, the uncoupling then of oxidative phosphorylation and the release of electrons out of the electron transport chain onto the mitochondrial membrane, which creates a singeing, a burning, a fire, to use the word by Dr. Sin, who talked about Parkinson's disease being the, quote, brain on fire, end quote, because of mitochondrial dysfunction and the oxidative stress that occurs within mitochondria. So the point I guess I'm really asking is, could we say that mitochondrial uniqueness from individual to individual plays a very significant role in their sensitivity to the environment, to allergens, to stress-related hormones, to toxins, which then creates, based on their own genetic uniqueness, different response to that, which then increases the oxidative potential and shifts the redox in that cell, the reduction oxidation potential, from the nice point of balance to where it's now shifted towards oxidative reactions, producing more lipid peroxides and secondary debris within cells, creating amyloid and leading to more rapid cell death and loss of organ reserve. So as we start to study mechanisms for the underlying loss of function with age, I think we're going well beyond just that of hyperhomocysteemia, just beyond that of the upregulated immune system. We're looking within the cell for things like peroxisome proliferation and things that create increased oxidative stress within the peroxisome or within the mitochondria, things that create altered gene expression that then modify the phenotype of the cell and put it in an alarm mode and in a catabolic metabolic function where it's breaking itself down rather than building itself back up. All of these are at the cornerstone, I think, of our better understanding of functionality and will take us away from the term alternative to a term good medicine, which is really, I think, what we've been talking about, introducing the best of science with the best of tradition, the best of experience across many disciplines to produce the best medicine, good medicine. And I think that's what these articles that appeared in JAMA talking about the trends in healthcare are all about, people selecting for a medicine, a form of healthcare delivery that really is consistent with their underlying belief system of celebrating tradition, observation, and experience while also asking for mechanisms and for understanding. Well, how does that relate to the way that we're providing medicine today, the so-called pharmacologically based medicine of today? And I think, again, just to go back and remind you of the extraordinary impact that the Journal of the American Medical Association published paper entitled Incidence of Adverse Drug Reactions in Hospital Patients had. This is going to be like the Eisenberg paper, I think, when we look back, because it's a call to arms suggesting that there are extraordinary number of premature deaths in people who have been administered medications at doses in hospitals as per the appropriate dose schedule. The adverse response was measured as death itself. This particular paper indicates that from 1994, overall 2,216,000 hospital patients had serious adverse drug reactions, and of those, 106,000 had fatal adverse drug reactions. And that's those that were hospitalized, not mentioning those that were at home administering medications to themselves, maybe less than ideally in many cases. So when we start looking at the impact of that on loss of organ reserve and premature dysfunction, with the ultimate endpoint being death itself, it raises a whole other concept of risk-benefit and trade-off and evaluating what might have previously been considered alternative in a new light, particularly if there's a mechanistic understanding of those alternatives as being more biologically sane and more reasonable. Even if the immediate remediation of symptoms is not as great as it would be with a specific drug, possibly over the longer term of outcome analysis, the risk-reward is much higher on the reward side, with a lower risk on the approach that's more biologically in tune with the function of that individual and their natural biological rhythms. Wasn't it interesting last month in Functional Medicine Update where I talked about rhythms and the fact that chemotherapeutic drugs administered cyclically with different rhythms throughout the day in a circadian rhythm with folate supplementation could produce lower side effects and better efficacy? I mean, think of how we're changing medicine just to throw into the scheme not just biological variability but also temporal variability throughout the day, timing, that we're like tides, high and low tides, and the rhythms and the patterns of our physiology change through the day, and therefore there may be better times of the day to administer one kind of therapy, another time of the day to administer another therapy, and that by doing that and using these rhythms that we can develop a more benevolent medicine that's more biologically based and one that really creates the opportunity for recovery of function, regaining lost organ reserve. Rather than treating everyone as a 70-kilogram human being whose symptoms call for a certain ICD-9, which then results in a certain treatment program with a specific drug who then may produce a specific adverse side effect, which requires another medication or treatment to ameliorate that symptom. So the patient becomes a study of one in their own program of response in the assumption that they are all like everyone else. I think that we're witnessing, aren't we, an extraordinary transformation in thinking about how healthcare is delivered, how the individual plays a role in their own treatment program, and what Dr. Leo Gallen talked about is patient-centered healthcare, in which the physician and the patient work together as a team to, in fact, construct a program that's based on the genetic uniqueness and the individual selection habits of that patient to promote improved health. Well, when we talk about adverse drug reactions, of course, we also have to talk about the fact, as Tolman's Law of Pharmacology tells us, that everything is toxic at some level. Gee whiz, what about nutrients? Because if you give those in high levels, aren't you worried also about adverse drug reactions with those as well? Well, there are many studies that have been published on this topic over the last few years, and there's a whole book written by Walter Hybe a number of years ago talking about the comparison of drug reactions to nutrient adverse reactions, and obviously the difference is huge in orders of magnitude in terms of the documented examples of adverse reactions to nutrients versus the adverse reactions to drugs, which are orders of magnitude more prevalent. But there are still concerns that we should all have about overuse of anything, because even air and water at a certain level can be toxic. We can be hyperoxygenated and we can be hyperhydrated. So Tolman's Law of Pharmacology says everything is toxic at some level. What we need to look at is the safe zone of application and the safe doses. That for vitamin C, for instance, has been assumed to be a very broad plateau of safety, a very broad zone from a few milligrams to thousands of milligrams of safety in most individuals. Yet we saw appear in Nature magazine, and I described this in a previous Functional Medicine Update issue, a report that British researchers had found that a supplement of 500 milligrams of vitamin C given daily affected the DNA bases within the chromosomes of individuals and led to mutational injury that could be suggested as associated with damaging effects of vitamin C and potentially even cancer. And so this University of Leicester study really has created quite a controversy worldwide about vitamin C supplementation, and people have been taking additional vitamin C daily as a supplement have suddenly started to say, wow, does this mean that I've been doing myself harm? And what I tried to tell you in the previous issue of Functional Medicine Update is that there is a wide controversy about the way that this study was actually done. It's a scientific methodology in terms of the extraction of the DNA out of the lymphocytes of these individuals. And it was very unusual because the oxidation of adenine was reported, but the reduction of guanine, it actually preserved the integrity of one of the bases, guanine, and prevented it from being oxidized, while it seemed to increase the oxidation of adenine. And so there was paradoxical. How could the same vitamin seem to be an anti-mutagen or an antioxidant in one case and a pro-oxidant or a pro-mutagen in another case, when given to the same individuals and looking at their same DNA? And, of course, what has been pointed out is that adenine is very susceptible to oxidation upon extraction, and there might have been artifactual post-extraction oxidation that occurred that accounts for this result, and therefore we should certainly take this study seriously, but we shouldn't rest a judgment as to its implications clinically, because it is very paradoxical that they report in this study that they got an antioxidant effect on guanine but a prooxidant effect on adenine. Well, lo and behold, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, this last couple of months, another interesting paper in the same area was published. Unfortunately, this didn't get the wire service attention, nor did it get the comments by Dr. Victor Herbert that did the previous Nature article study. And this particular paper is entitled Effects of Flavonoids and Vitamin C on Oxidative DNA Damage to Human Lymphocytes. And in this study, they also assessed the antioxidant potencies of several widespread dietary flavonoids and vitamin C against a positive control. What they looked at were the damage to DNA. Now, they didn't use the same assay methods for DNA analysis. They didn't do base analysis. They looked at fluorescence intensity profiles of what are called COMETs. So these are electrophoresed cell nuclei with different grades of damage. So this is a more morphological study using flow cytometry, looking at the damage to DNA on a morphological perspective rather than on some biochemical perspective. And again, what they found was that there was a significant protection of damage by vitamin C, and other flavonoids could then enhance the antioxidant protection. The protective effect of quercetin and vitamin C concentrations was found to be additive and could help to oppose the hydrogen peroxide exposure to the cells. And therefore, it appears as if in this study that the addition of various flavonoids from the diet with vitamin C certainly participates in an antioxidant protective effect against DNA damage or chromosomal damage. So one might ask the question, again, difference in methods of assay, difference of in vivo versus in vitro, also could be looking at the effects that complex antioxidant systems have in protecting cell damage versus single antioxidants. I would come back to say that the evidence that seems to be emerging clinically is that giving antioxidants as a complement family of redox active substances seems to be far preferable to giving single antioxidants to an individual who has a depleted diet. So if you take a person who's eating a high carbohydrate diet, meaning they're drinking Coca-Cola and they're eating potato chips and Snickers bars, that's a high carbohydrate diet of the wrong type, that if you then just supplemented them with vitamin C all by itself, that is very different than eating a diet that is balanced in its natural flavonoid-containing antioxidants and carotenoid-containing antioxidants along with a vitamin C supplement. And I believe that our recommendation should always be to eat a diet that's as rich in the natural phytochemicals, phytonutrients as possible, while also taking antioxidant supplements that are balanced with the tocopherols, the ascorbate, the flavonoids, and the carotenoids. And that way you get the full benefit of the electron transfer reactions that occur from one agent to another as ascorbyl radical is trapped by tocopherol, as tocopherol radical is trapped by glutathione, as glutathione is regenerated by from its disulfide back to glutathione by flavonadenine nucleotide in its reduced form. This is a family of interacting components that give rise to the proper control of redox and the diffusing of the chemical tie bombs that we call oxidant-free radicals or free radical substances. In closure, what I would say is certainly we need to be concerned about the overuse of any specific nutrient, but the dose response safety range for nutrients is in the main much broader than that it is for drugs, and that by using complement families of things like antioxidants, we get the full benefit of protection and the diffusing or the lowered energy reactions of free radicals that are finally decontaminated or denatured down to their non-spin state. What happens then if a person exposes their genes to other agents that would upregulate oxidative stress reactions and encourage then the uncoupling of oxidative function within the mitochondria and create damage to the mitochondria, particularly those that have genetic unique susceptibilities? These might be people that are, for instance, poor sulfoxidizers or people that are poor glucuronidators or individuals with specific mitochondrial mutations that make them more susceptible to certain types of toxic exposures. Well, that has been obviously the object of many individual studies looking for the impact that chronic exposure to various toxins have on system function, neurological function, immune function. And a very interesting recent paper appeared in the American Academy of Neurology journal, Neurology, volume 50, page 1346 in 1998, entitled "The Risk of Parkinson's Disease with Exposure to Pesticides Farming Well Water in Rural Living." What these investigators did was to assess exposure to pesticides farming well water in rural living as risk factors potential for Parkinson's disease. This was a study done up in Michigan looking at individuals who were patients at the Henry Ford Health System in Detroit and trying to examine whether farming was an occupational risk factor to various types of neurologic disorders with Parkinson's as a specific endpoint for analysis. The association of farming with Parkinson's disease in the study was maintained after adjustment for occupational herbicide exposure and was borderline significance after adjustment for occupational insecticide exposure. The results suggest that Parkinson's disease is associated with occupational exposure to herbicides and insecticides, and particularly to those who have a specific genetic risk due to altered detoxification mechanisms, and therefore the combination of an exposure with a genetic risk gives rise to an outcome of increasing risk to neurological dysfunction. Again, as we've discussed in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update, the mechanism that's emerging for the origin of Parkinson's relates again to mitochondrial uncoupling, mitochondrial burnout, the mitochondria or the brain on fire, as I've discussed earlier. And therefore, an environmental factor coupled with a genetic risk gives rise to an outcome which was previously called a disease of unknown origin. It's called idiopathic Parkinsonianism. Idiopathic Parkinson's disease constitutes 85% of the case. Only 15% have known etiology. Now I think we're starting to see these 85% with unknown etiology may be very likely a result of this complex interaction of genetic risk factors with environmental exposure. Well, in an individual who has suboptimal detoxification, we not only want to reduce their exposure to these toxins, but we also want to improve their relative detoxification and protection of their mitochondria against oxidative stress. We know that diet can play a role in all of these factors. Certainly, it plays a role in supporting proper detoxification function, getting the most out of our detoxification gene expression. We know, for instance, that the cruciferous vegetable families we've discussed in the past, the members include broccoli and cauliflower, Brussels sprouts and cabbage, have glucosinolate phytochemicals within them that are able to speak to the genes in such a way as to upregulate the expression of the detoxification enzyme systems, particularly phase 2 detoxification systems. In recent papers that appeared in the journal Carcinogenesis, volume 19, pages 605, and volume 19, page 611, there are reports of glucosinolates from the cruciferous vegetables having an influence on the detoxification of potential carcinogens, both in vivo and in vitro, and that they can also be found to inhibit apoptosis in human cancer cell lines and improve then the regulation of cellular function. So can diet play a role? Well, yes. First of all, diet that's contaminated can play a role by addition of toxins, but secondly, a diet that's natural and rich in a variety of nutrients and phytonutrients can, in fact, increase and improve certain genetic expression patterns that are associated with detoxification and with resistance to oxidative stress. A very interesting concept. So let's just summarize what we've tried to discuss on this side of Functional Medicine Update. We have said that there is a consumer trend that's moving more and more towards what's been euphemistically called alternative medicine, which might be better termed complementary functional good medicine, and that this is built on a belief system that has to tie in a holistic pattern the life stream, the biological background, the environmental belief system of the individual to their medicine. This then is rooted in a scientific methodology that somehow emerges out of our better understanding of genes and how the environment influences them. We've given some examples, including hyperhomocysteemia. We talked about the relationship of maintenance of organ reserve, the James Freeze concept, through practicing the right things throughout our life that are matched to our genes. And then lastly, we've talked about detoxification and its relationship to neurological disorders when we're exposed to toxins, particularly those individuals that have certain mitochondria mitochondrial DNA mutations or certain oxidative stress susceptibilities, which then creates an opportunity for them to be at higher risk to what were previously called diseases of unknown origin, which now are being called functional disorders that start early in life that later, upon significant loss of organ reserve, become named pathologies. And recall for Parkinson's as an example, as Clue told us in his wonderful paper on Parkinson published in The Lancet some 7 years ago, that you need to lose 70% of your dopaminergic neurons in the nigra before you actually start to exhibit the clinical symptoms and well-diagnosed Parkinson's disease. And therefore, you've got a long period where neuroprotective therapy can be introduced if you understand the right thing early on from a functional perspective. It is with that, then, we'll turn to side two of this month's Functional Medicine and hear from our extraordinary interviewee for this month, Professor Regina Hertzlinger. In our tradition of having some very interesting, provocative, and mind-expanding presenters and visitors to Functional Medicine Update, we are very pleased this month to continue on that trend, having a professor of business, Professor Regina Hertzlinger from Harvard School of Business. Professor Hertzlinger is the Nancy R. McPherson Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School and has been focusing and become really quite an expert in the whole area of healthcare assessment and the economics and trend analysis in healthcare. And her recent book, actually a 1997 Addison Wesley book entitled Market-Driven Healthcare, Who Wins, Who Loses in the Transformation of America's Largest Service Industry, has been for me a tremendous transformation in my thinking and a real education and awakening of some of the things that are really happening within the field that we all share and how this might change the future and how we see the future and vision ourselves as part of that future. So it's with great pleasure and privilege that we have Professor Hertzlinger today as a guest on Functional Medicine Update. And I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is, there are many market forces that are now working upon the healthcare system. What are these, as you see them, the predominant market forces that are shaping the healthcare system, Professor Hertzlinger?
Well, one force is the consumers, and consumers nowadays are very smart, and even if they're not smart, they think they're smart, which is the same thing. They're well-educated, they're assertive, they're pragmatic, and although they love their physicians, and they like nurses, and they like medical technology, they're very unhappy with the managed care movement, which essentially says no to these activist, assertive, pragmatic people. Second market force are employers who in the United States pay for a large share of the health care bill. And this bill was spinning out of control, and they thought they found a magic bullet with managed care. And it turned out, rather than being a magic bullet, this managed care movement was more like a gun to their heads. Because as employees became more and more unhappy with managed care, they took their complaints to the media and to the Congress, and they made the employers feel very bad about their choices. And secondly, many HMOs are raising their rates at much faster rates than the increase in inflation in the economy as a whole. So they're not controlling healthcare costs, and they're causing a lot of unhappiness among employees. The U.S. has a 4% unemployment rate. Keeping and finding good employees is very hard, and the last thing employers want is dissatisfaction with health care.
I was very intrigued and pleased to see the quote by Dr. Daniel Johnson, Jr., president of the American Medical Association, on the cover of your book, in which he was quoted as saying, based on remarkable insight into the problems of our healthcare system, market-driven healthcare shows us how to transform our system into a more cost-effective one by putting the patient in the driver's seat with the doctor riding shotgun. Do you think that's an accurate perception of some of the things that these market forces may create within the field of medicine?
Dr. Johnson is a remarkable person and a very visionary and charismatic man, and I think he very nicely encapsulated what my book is about and indeed what's happening in healthcare. And in the healthcare system of the future, there'll be a Back to the Future movement with a partnership between customers and their physicians. Physicians will take up more and more of the actual management of care and interact directly with their customers. In business parlance, the insurance function will be disintermediated. This intermediary will have less and less of a say, and the physicians and the customers will have more and more of a say of what goes on in healthcare.
Well, I'm sure that the listeners to this tape, who are principally physicians, will find that extraordinarily exciting for them, who are principally dedicated to their patients, and this is the reason why they came into medicine. You talk about focused factories. It's a term you've coined to describe a trend. Could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by focused factories?
Focused factories are organizations that revolutionized manufacturing. And it used to be that in the manufacturing sector we had in the United States these great big vertically integrated factories. In other words, they produced most of the components that were used in their end products themselves. And the factories produced a very wide range of goods and services. When global competition came in the 1970s and 1980s, these factories were very inefficient because it's hard to make a big range of products and keep a good level of excellence in all of those products. And it's very hard to manufacture everything yourself and be as good as somebody who is just manufacturing a very narrow part of what you're manufacturing. So what American firms did is they established focused factories, and these focused factories manufacture a very small product line, and they only manufacture those things in which they have distinctive competence. Our service sector, which is probably the best part of the U.S. economy, is also very focused. A firm like FedEx or an airline like Southwest Airlines, the thing that they have in common, they're both extraordinary firms. They're very high quality, very low cost. But the thing that they have in common is you can describe their product line in a couple of words. They're very focused. They do what they do well, and that's all they do. There are plenty of applications for the same concept in healthcare, because healthcare costs are very concentrated. For example, 80% of healthcare costs can be attributed to a handful of chronic diseases. Most surgeries, 80% of them, are incurred by a handful of surgical procedures. Most disabilities can be traced to a handful of causes. In the rest of the economy, the way the sector would be structured is it would be focused on these chronic diseases, focused on these surgical procedures, focused on these disabilities, because in the rest of the economy, focus brings higher quality and lower cost. And that's what will happen in the healthcare system. We're going to have focused healthcare factories, and they're going to be led by physicians in partnership with business people.
Could you give us a couple of examples of focus factories as you see them in the healthcare sector that are already emerging?
Be very glad to. There are hundreds of them, and they've been funded primarily by the venture capitalists. Venture capitalists are the people who created the biotechnology industry, the telecommunications industry, the software industry, and they're now investing in healthcare-focused factories. One good example is a diabetes-focused factory, and these are organizations that manage all aspects of diabetes, including the comorbidities that are very frequent in diabetes, like heart disease, which in fact is the number one cost driver of diabetes, kidney disease, eye disease, problems with feet, ulceration, and so on. So the diabetes-focused factory is not a group of endocrinologists. There are endocrinologists there, but there are also nephrologists, cardiologists, social workers to work with the diabetics and help them to comply with the very demanding regimens that they have. These diabetes-focused factories reduce the incidence of kidney dialysis by an astonishing percent, and they drive down the costs of treating diabetes, not by denying care to people, but by helping them with the self-care that's so important for the management of diabetes. A surgical-focused factory is one that was created by Dr. Denton Cooley, who's a world-famous cardiac surgeon. Dr. Cooley runs a focused factory that specializes in CABGs. His quality is, of course, extraordinarily high. because Dr. Cooley is such a great surgeon and because he's done 80,000 open heart surgeries. What's interesting is his price in 1994 was 33% lower than the price of a general purpose hospital whose quality is unknown. And why is that? It's because practice makes perfect. When you're focused, you get a lot of practice, and being perfect reduces the cost of mistakes, which is the real driver of the high healthcare costs.
Two of the areas that seem to be expanding areas of medical interest and health concern relate to woman-centered health issues, given the fact that we have this very large number of women coming into menopause as a consequence of the baby boomers now getting to that age, and secondly, men's health issues surrounding things like benign prostatic hyperplasia and prostate-related problems. Are those suitable, do you think, for focus
Absolutely.
Factories?
I've seen a number of business plans, and there are organizations that focus on the prostate or even focus on particular procedures to treat benign prostate disease. And there are a number of organizations that have already arisen to serve the women market. I'm not aware of one that has particularly arisen to serve the menopausal women's market, but I'm sure it will arise because, as you say, Dr. Bland, quite correctly and astutely, it's such a large market and it's very underserved. And wherever this consumer feels underserved, there's a great opportunity to create the focused organizations that will meet their needs.
As you envision the evolution of focus factories in the healthcare sector, do you see these to be third-party reimbursed, or are they going to be paid out of pocket, or a combination of funding mechanisms? How will the patient pay for these services?
Most of these will be third-party reimbursed. Now, here's the good news, bad news for the physician. The physicians will manage these organizations because, after all, who knows better than the physician how to manage the provision of health care? The notion that some third party knows better than the doctor is ridiculous. But physicians will have to take financial responsibility for providing that care within a given parameter. So in the future, the focused factories will offer their services at a fixed rate to insurers. They will also have outcome measurements, and you know, it's much easier to measure the outcomes of a focused factory than it is to measure the outcomes of an everything for everybody integrated delivery system. The good news is the physicians will have the autonomy to decide how to deliver appropriate care. The bad news is they're going to have the responsibility for delivering that care.
When we look at trends that are upon us right now, and particularly focused on the healthcare trends, one can't help but be struck by the impact that the 1993 article authored by David Eisenberg et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine on unconventional medicine in the United States, prevalence, costs, and patterns of use has had in opening the mind to medicine that, gee, there is this second or third tier medicine that's going on called alternative or unconventional medicine. And that's been followed up by a recent paper by John Aston in the Journal of the American Medical Association, May 20th, 1998, entitled Why Patients Use Alternative Medicine, Results of a National Study. Both of these papers together signal that there is a growing group of reasonably well-informed, college-educated individuals who are seeking out different kinds of care that I guess would be considered alternative to that which they traditionally have been provided by standard physicians. Do you see this as a market force variable that will influence some of these focus factories and delivery services?
Absolutely. I'd like to restate the origins of this trend. The origin is a very assertive, pragmatic, educated consumer who, when they are dissatisfied with traditional sources of services, whether those are retailing services, accounting services, legal services, or medical services, will turn to some other provider. Most of the users of alternative, or as it's now called, complementary medicine, are very well educated. They're not blue-collar or under-educated people, and many of them are people who have chronic diseases or disabilities who've been unable to find relief or sufficient relief through the traditional healthcare system. There are two focused factories that are very well capitalized that have emerged to treat this market. One is a company called American Whole Health. which provide, according to their business plan, health centers, both traditional medicine and alternative medicine. The other is a company called WellSpace, and WellSpace provides care only for complementary kinds of providers, and they view themselves as being a point to which the traditional purveyor of medicine can refer his or her patients.
When we look at the trends and the dynamics that have produced these trends, one of the other articles that I think stands as a watershed in the medical literature is an article that was published in 1983 by a professor of medicine who we've had as a previous presenter on Functional Medicine Update, Dr. James Fries, who's in the Department of Preventive Medicine. And he wrote an article, or was the principal author on an article entitled Aging, Natural Death, and the Compression of Morbidity, where he describes that we can improve the health span of our population if we can compress illness into but the last phase of life by investing in health promotion early on, things like exercise, eating right, stress reduction, avoidance of excess alcohol and cigarette smoking, that kind of approach. And it was highly criticized by some of his medical colleagues who said there was no evidence that you could actually compress morbidity by investing in health promotion at a younger age. And he's come back with a more recent paper in 1998 entitled Aging, Health Risk, and Cumulative Disability that again appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine that seems to support the 18-year-ago paper in terms of its outcome, now looking retrospectively at people who did invest in their health and have compressed morbidity. Now I guess the question is, do you see that these concepts of investing in health promotion at a younger age will become part of the focus or part of the objectives of our healthcare system, and will there be an economic driver for it as we move into the new millennium?
Very good question. I've been fortunate enough to know Jim Fries for quite a while, and I write about his work in my book, In Market-Driven Healthcare, and I had early evidence of my own. I wrote the book in 1997 to support his hypothesis. He's absolutely right, and his latest article provides very strong credence for it. The focused factory will have great incentive to invest in promoting people's health and in helping them take care of themselves. When a focused factory is paid a fixed price for the care of their customer, and when they want to make sure that that customer stays with them and doesn't go someplace else, one of the best ways to achieve more cost-effective care is to make sure that the diabetic monitors his or her disease and takes insulin appropriately, to make sure that the asthmatic complies with their anti-inflammatory medication regimen and knows how to use a whiffer appropriately. In today's system, nobody is motivated to do those things, and as a result, diabetics and asthmatics use healthcare resources inappropriately in the sense that they use resources that could have been avoided with enough help in self-care and proper monitoring and diagnosis. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think physicians are wonderful, and the failures to deal with self-care and health promotion issues are not the faults of the physicians, but the fault of a system where everybody does everything, and when you do everything for everybody, some things are going to fall through the cracks. Diabetics account for only 3% of our population, known diabetics. Their care is tremendously complex. It's no wonder that they fall through the cracks. Same thing for asthmatics. But when these people are enrolled in focused factories and the focused factory providers are paid a fixed fee for care of their enrollees, they have every incentive in the world, and they also have the right organizational structure to make sure that those enrollees get the help that they need.
It's a very, very exciting concept. We're just about out of time, but I did want to ask you one last question, and that is many of our physicians who regularly listen to and support Functional Medicine Update are people who have gone through an era of some disillusionment. They have gone through maybe the golden age of medicine where the physician and the patient was the principal relationship of importance, and now they move into an era where it seems like economic modeling, microeconomics, and financial management is the golden control of medicine. And I guess I'd like to
ask you, do you feel that for the doctor who is really patient-centered, really concerned about the quality of care of their patient and really wants to stay in medicine and be a service to their patient, that there will be a future for them as these trends evolve?
Excellent question. I can't tell you how sad I am as I travel across the country and I do book signings after my lecture to meet wonderful people who are about my age in their 50s, and they say to me, I'm leaving medicine, I just can't take it anymore. I think, in fact, what is happening, if they'll just hang in there, is they'll once again have a reaffirmation of the patient-doctor relationship, and if the physicians are willing to take the financial risk that's required, they will be able to get this third party who has encroached on their autonomy and depressed them because of the physician's feelings that they can no longer practice medicine as they deem appropriate. This third party will be gotten out of the way. So the best is yet to come.
We've been listening to Professor Regina Hertzlinger from the Harvard School of Business and the author of a book that should be mandatory reading for all of us, Market-Driven Healthcare, Who Wins, Who Loses in the Transformation of America's Largest Service Industry. And Professor Hertzlinger, I want to thank you so much for an uplifting and very informationally dense 20 minutes with us. And I wish you the continued best in your advocacy.
Thank you, Dr. Bland. You're so erudite. It's really a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Following from Professor Hertzlinger's very eloquent comments, I'd like to talk about one other area that could likely be one of these focus factories area of interest, and that surrounds gastrointestinal health and how it relates to the immune system. Because there seems to be a ever-emerging understanding of the broad range of health problems that derive out of an activated immunological status of the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and the MALT, the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, and the complex interaction that has with various other components of the body that give rise to multifactorial types of symptoms. I'll speak to that in just a moment, but remind you that there was a report that appeared in The Lancet now 3 years ago that there was a hypothesis article discussing the interesting relationship, very high statistical correlation, between non-specific gluten enteropathy, not tropical sprue, but chronic enteropathy that relates to gluten sensitivity, and early-stage dementia. It's a very strong statistical relationship. And, of course, the authors of this hypothesis article were proposing that there's a causal potential link between low-level gluten sensitivity and dementia that is created through activation of the GALT, increased release from the gut-associated lymphoid tissue of pro-inflammatory markers that are represented by members of the cytokine family like interleukin-2 and tumor necrosis factor alpha. These cell communicating molecules then create an environment within the neurologic system that upregulates glial immunological activity, producing more nitric oxide, which then uncouples oxidative metabolism in the mitochondria of the neurons, producing oxidative stress and neuronal burnout, apoptotic cell changes, increased levels of NF-kappa-B, calcium uptake across cells, and quicker or more rapid cell aging. On a biochemical or cell biological level, this is almost an expression of the James Freeze whole organism loss of organ reserve. And now we're talking about the connection between the gut and the brain. Reminds me of the old song, remember the foot bones connected to the ankle bone, and everything works as a web. And so the concept was that an activated immune system of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue could in part then, based upon the genetic susceptibility factors of the individual, different kinds of distant symptoms, including increased loss of neuronal function and early-stage dementia. Well, following this up, there's a very interesting additional series of papers that have come out recently. One that I think you'll find interesting is, again, from The Lancet, Volume 351, in the May 23rd issue, 1998, entitled Brain White Matter Lesions and Inflammatory Bowel Disease. As I mentioned to you, it's been reported that 42% of patients with Crohn's disease and 46% of patients with ulcerative colitis have small white matter lesions on magnetic resonance imaging. These changes were found in only 16% of healthy controls, suggesting almost a threefold increase in these lesions in the individuals with inflammatory conditions of the gut. The authors of the paper suggest that these abnormalities might be of ischemic origin, secondary to atherosclerosis or vasculitis, and the possibility of demyelination has also been raised. They go on to suggest then that there is a very strong correlation between the observations in this study and several other studies that have been published showing neurological dysfunction and loss of myelin in the central nervous system in individuals with inflammatory process of the gut. So again, the exact mechanism has not yet been worked out, but it certainly suggests that the connection through inflammatory mediators of the brain to the gut is somehow interrelated with what it is that it causes the initial inflammation of the gut and how that impacts the gut-associated lymphoid tissue and its central messaging to the rest of the brain. Well, we know that the gastrointestinal tract is a major site of cell-mediated and non-cell-mediated immunological function. Recently, we've seen a report that the individuals who have HIV infection are individuals whose gastrointestinal mucosal activity of their lymphoid tissue is altered significantly. In fact, the GI tract mucosa is a major site of CD4 T-cell depletion and probably precedes the depletion of T-cells elsewhere in the body. It's also a major site for viral replication in HIV infection. This was recently reported in Science Magazine, Volume 280, page 427 in 1998, and probably, again, describes why there are so many gastrointestinal symptoms associated with individuals with HIV infection, because the principal site for the immunological battle is at the gut itself, which then later transcends the gut and moves to the rest of the body, producing the dementia of AIDS and all the other symptomatologies that we see, including the Kaposi sarcoma, which is a cancer that is associated with AIDS as it relates to altered genomic expression. So as we start to look at focus factories, we might look at complementary practitioners working together around the array of symptomatologies from inflammation, arthritis, heart disease, loss of neurological function associated with altered gut immunological function. Obviously, the function of the gut immunological system is a complex relationship between genes and stress factors, psychogenic stress factors, chemical stress factors, the dietary factors, chronic infection of the gut, which we call dysbiosis. All of these things give rise to an altered gastrointestinal immunological function, which then has potential influences on distant symptoms in the body based upon genetic uniqueness. Let's go back and examine gluten again, because I think that's an emerging story which deserves more attention. Gluten, as you know, or alpha-gliadin, which is a major protein found in many grains, particularly wheat, is consumed in reasonably high quantities by individuals who move themselves towards a high-complex carbohydrate, unrefined diet, because as such, obviously, wheat and oats become a more significant component of their diet to make up for the calories that they're eliminating that are coming from animal products that are high in saturated fats. Gliadin, which is a protein in gluten of grains, is a reactive protein in some individuals who carry certain genetic susceptibilities. There has been an association between gliadin exposure in the diet and celiac disease. Celiac disease, you know, is characterized by inflammation of the small intestine, which induces mucosal transformation, villous atrophy, and hyperplasia, and a malabsorption. And this can be seen through altered types of absorptive tests which look for leaky gut syndrome. It's triggered by the gliadins, well-defined proteins in wheat, barley, and rye, and oats, and these are the major cereals consumed in Western society, and so one who has this genetic predisposition, which has been associated with the HLA antibody locus called DQ2 of the major histocompatibility complex, is found in 95% of the patients who have celiac disease. It's known that certain gliadin peptides stimulate T lymphocytes from the intestinal lesion, and the nature of this immunogenic gliadin sequence still remains controversial, but clearly there's something unique about the polypeptide sequence of the protein in gliadin and its interrelationship with receptor sites on the mucosal surface of the gut and activation then of the inflammatory process. This goes back very nicely, I think, to previous discussions we've had and actually the interview we had with Dr. Peter Diadamo, in which he was talking about blood typing and the relationship to diet sensitivities, looking at type ABO blood typing, showing that, in fact, those individuals who carry certain lectin receptor surfaces and certain genetically determined receptor sites on the mucosa may be much more susceptible to certain food families in terms of the chemical communication between reactive proteins and these receptor sites. It's as if it's a chemical mimicry of their own biological response system that comes from their dietary persuasions, which then activates their immunological system and produces these pro-inflammatory markers. In a recent issue of Nature Medicine, this is volume 4, page 713 in 1998, an article was published entitled Tissue Transglutamase Selectively Modifying Gliotin Peptides That Are Recognized by the Gut-Derived T-Cells in Celiac Disease. This is a report that extends our knowledge of this pathogenesis of celiac. The authors show that the deamidation of gliadin unmasks the epitopes that bind HLA-DQ2 on antigen-presenting cells and are recognized by gut-derived T-cells from celiac patients. The investigators who are from the Institute of Pathology at the medical school in Oslo, Norway, were able to show that the T-cell lines derived from celiac patients are less responsive to proteolytic digestion of the gliadin protein, and therefore they preserve some of these antigenic determinants because they don't break down dietary protein all the way to non-immunogenic amino acids. So here's a case of non-complete protein breakdown leading to small peptide fragments, which in the guts of individuals who carry this specific receptor site on their gut mucosal tissue then produces an upregulation of their inflammatory system. In a sense, these proteoid molecules are then eaten by the gut mucosa, are taken up by invagination, and then initiate this responsive reaction within the MALT, the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. That then produces a whole sequence and cascade of effects that ultimately works its way through the cell-mediated and non-cell-mediated components of the lymphoid system, producing alterations in CD4 and in tumor necrosis factor alpha release, which then upregulates inflammatory reactions both locally and systemically. So when we go back to the original discussion about how is the brain connected to the gut, connected to the diet, we're starting to piece together a mechanism that explains this complex interrelationship. And so our genetic inheritance, the food that we select, our dietary habits that then influence floral ecology of our gut, in other words, the bacteria that live within our gut mucosa and how that relates to digestion, our pancreatic function and how well we can break down food proteins to their non-immunogenic amino acids, and then our absorptive functions and how that relates then to immunological effects both in the mucosa of the gut and the liver itself with its embedded Kupffer cells, which are lymphocytes that have immunological function within the liver. All of these work together then to signal to the rest of the body potential mechanisms that are related to pro-inflammation that then can be seen as arthritis or could be seen as increased risk to inflammatory-induced atherogenesis, or it could be related to conditions that maybe even be dementia. By the way, I just talked about our coronary artery disease and inflammation. I think, again, I need to remind you that there's an ever-increasing understanding that one of the contributors to the origin, the pathogenesis of heart disease or coronary artery disease is inflammatory related components. In fact, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 279, page 1477 in 1998, there's a very interesting report showing that if we look at fibrinogen, C-reactive protein, albumin, and leukocyte count, and it's associated with coronary heart disease, that there's a very strong correlation between C-reactive protein elevations, leukocyte count elevations, and coronary heart disease, suggesting again that there's an inflammatory marker, inflammatory pathogenesis that's associated with heart disease, just as Virchow, the German physiologist, proposed back in the 19th century. So we're starting to revisit with some degree of specificity that inflammatory markers in genetically susceptible individuals may again increase the likelihood for the stickiness of a white cell to a arterial wall, which then infiltrates the artery and creates then a conversion into the foam cell, which can initiate LDL oxidation and start the atherogenic process. So increased inflammatory markers, increased production of intracellular adhesion molecules, increased stickiness then of white cells to the artery wall, increased infiltration of the white cell into the artery wall, and conversion then into foam cells and oxidative pathogenesis being the result. How does that all relate back to wheat in the diet? Well, I think you can see that there is a much more complex web-like understanding of this, starting with the gut and the diet and floral ecology and digestion and immunological function than we may previously have been trained to understand. The focused factory may be the place where the disciplines represented around this particular topic area can collaborate to functionally improve the patient before they start to experience end-organ disease by looking at these early warning markers for dysbiosis, upregulation of gut inflammatory markers, effects on Kupffer cells, cytokine release, and oxidative stress reactions. By the way, there's ever-increasing evidence to indicate that a biotherapeutic approach towards remediation of these problems is of value. I'm stealing a term here from the Journal of the American Medical Association paper that appeared some months ago. I think it was actually in the March issue of 1996, in which they described the biotherapeutic approach towards the management of chronic intestinal infections and chronic vaginitis, a neglected modality, as they say, which is basically the administration of Acidophilus, Bifidus, and prebiotics. This is very similar to what we have been calling the 4R program for the past 6 years. The 4R program is the gastrointestinal restoration program that engages, the 4R stand for remove, which means get rid of the allergens and the toxic bacterial overgrowth of dysbiotic bacteria, the infection in other words. The second R is replace, add back where necessary digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid to acidify the chyme. The third R is reinoculate, which means add back the friendly probiotic organisms, the bifidobacteria and the acidophilus. The last R, the fourth R, it stands for repair, add back the nutrients that are necessary to help regenerate gut mucosal integrity, L-glutamine, zinc, non-irritating form, vitamin E, pantothenic acid, inulin, those nutrients that are helpful for increasing butyrate formation from the friendly bacteria, the symbiotic bacteria in the gut. So this represents a therapeutic nutritional support program that is utilized for those individuals who have dysfunctional GALT, who have upregulated immunological function of their GALT. And if we start looking in the literature at papers that have described the value of this type of intervention, there are many that have talked about it, both from pediatric perspective as well as adult perspective. Relationship between intestinal colonization of bifidobacteria and its relationship then to proper immune function is published in, well, a whole series of papers and tied together with dietary fiber and tied together with inulin and fructose oligosaccharides that help to support the growth of the friendly bacteria. How does that then lower mucosal antibodies seen in inflammatory bowel disease? Well, interesting papers show, for instance, one that was published in the journal Gut, volume 38, page 365 in 1996, show that by introducing this kind of a program, you can actually lower antibodies against mucosal proteins and lower the inflammatory reactions in the bowel. So I think that we're starting to see emerge a theme that says that the gut may be a central point where much of our first signal messengers for immunological upregulation and inflammation begins, and then a second signal messenger trigger is laid on top of that that then produces a symptom such as allergic arthritis or specific kind of response to a muscle protein that we see as a fibromyalgia, and now we have a generalized disease that or condition that we can diagnose whose etiology may have had the first stage of control at the gut level. In infants, this is a very well studied area, and certainly the biotherapeutic intervention has been proven useful. We know that, for instance, in a paper, Annals of Surgery, volume 227, page 547, in 1998, abnormal gut flora was found in infants who received parenteral nutrition. These were premature infants, and when they were renourished then with lactobacillus acidophilus and the prebiotics like fructooligosaccharides, their gut flora returned to normal, and their recovery and improvement after surgery was improved. We also know that there is a very significant change in fermentation products in the guts of infants that are breastfed versus those that are fed other types of formula. This is an interesting paper that appeared in the Journal of Nutrition, volume 128, page 85, in 1998, in which the investigators showed that there were actual increases in ethanol production from gut fermentation of carbohydrate by yeast that was overgrowing the infant's gut until they were shifted over to mother's breast milk, and then the ethanol levels, the drinking alcohol levels in their blood went down and in their breath because they were less supporting the growth of yeast and these fermenting organisms and more supporting than proper gastrointestinal digestion and physiology. So I think we can see a whole range of clinical symptoms that can come out of a disturbed gut flora, a disturbed digestive process, and a mismatch of the diet and its proteins with that of the genetic needs of the individual, which later become medical treatment problems for which the downstream might be called arthritis. But the upstream cause etiology is really related to an activated immune system. Well, one of the things that we've learned about upregulated immune systems and increased inflammatory markers is that this is also associated with increased oxidative stress for reasons that I've described earlier, in part pertaining to altered mitochondrial function and other cellular materials who then produce oxidant secondary byproducts. We know for a fact that there are many antioxidants that help defend against and prevent oxidative damage. These include, obviously, vitamin E and its close relative, tocotrienol. And I think it's very interesting to see in the literature right now the number of papers that are being published on the benefit of tocotrienols. These are members of the natural vitamin E complex family. Tocotrienols have been found to inhibit the growth of human breast cancer cells, irrespective of estrogen receptor status. They've been found to lower cholesterol levels because they seem to be HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. They've been found to help protect against oxidative stress of nitric oxide-induced reactions in the mitochondria, along with the gamma-tocopherol, one of the members of the natural tocopherol family. So tocotrienols, they're, by the way, found in fairly high concentrations in palm oil. The origin of these in concentrates are from palm oil origin generally, or from barley extracts. There are also some in rice oil as well. And tocotrienols have been found to have a very significant range of effects in modulation gene expression and preventing oxidative stress that work synergistically along with the tocopherols. By the way, the discussion I was just having about human breast cancer cells, irrespective of estrogen status, estrogen receptor status, comes from a recent paper published in the journal Lipids, volume 33, page 461, in 1998. We also know that the vitamin E family is very high in soy, and soy contains a whole range of very powerful antioxidant substances that work together again as a team, not just the tocopherols, but also soy lignans and soy steroids and the phytonutrients of the isoflavone family, genistein and diazine. There's a new Japanese study that was just published that I found fascinating that showed that soy helped to prevent heart disease because it lowers cholesterol levels very significantly through a variety of impacts. This confirms the meta-analysis study that was published by James Anderson in the New England Journal of Medicine a number of years ago that we reviewed in Functional Medicine Update that showed that in many studies there is the trend analysis demonstrates that soy consumption causes an alteration in both cholesterol synthesis and cholesterol conversion to bile and its elimination in the feces, and therefore helps to lower serum cholesterol as a natural hypocholesterolemic. In this particular recent paper from Japan, entitled Decreased Total Cholesterol Levels is Associated with High Intake of Soy Products in Japanese Men and Women, they looked at the diets of 1,242 men and 3,596 women who were part of a larger 31,000-person study, so the so-called Takayama study, which is investigating the role of diet and lifestyle in the development of cancer. A study found that soy can have positive benefits in lowering cholesterol levels and in some cases can produce effects that are as dramatic as that as one gets with the statin drugs. They found similar results as it relates to the modification of hormones as well. So there may be a whole range of modulating effects that soy and its constituents have on cholesterol, cholesterol dynamics, and its conversion ultimately into its secondary metabolites, which are the steroid hormones. This might explain effects on prostate function in men and breast function in women in those that consume higher soy-based diets. The point I want to leave you with is that there is a whole range of very interesting antioxidants that come from diet, but one that I think has received the most interesting attention recently is a natural material in our blood that we've often been very concerned about in the pathological basis due to condition of gout, and that's uric acid. It's now being recognized that uric acid may be a response to an oxidative stress. Uric acid may actually be a pretty important antioxidant. In fact, there's a recent report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, volume 95, page 675 in 1998, entitled Uric Acid, a Natural Scavenger of Peroxynitrite in Experimental Allergic Encephalomyelitis and Multiple Sclerosis, suggesting that uric acid is actually a scavenger of the peroxynitrite oxidant that occurs as a consequence of the upregulated immune system in a pro-inflammatory state, and that possibly hyperuricemia is the response to an oxidative stress that occurs as a consequence of an upregulated immune system, not just the cause itself, which we may have previously jumped to that conclusion. This is very similar, isn't it, to the cholesterol story, where cholesterol may be elevated as a response to a stress, not be the cause itself. So I think we should stay tuned. Many of these agents of responsive molecules are telling us a story whose interpretation of the story now is more based upon newly emergent scientific understanding. understanding and will lead, I think, to the transformation of what might have been considered in the past to be alternative and conventional therapy to become highly based in science, just as is the homocysteine story starting to be called that of traditional medicine. I will see you in September and have a great August.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.